Hello and welcome, listeners and friends. You are listening to a reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, June 25th, 2021. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Why don't we go ahead and have a look around today's front page headlines. First up, Tyson attorneys seek to move COVID lawsuit to federal court. Today's big feature story is battery of fireworks stands now open in Council Bluffs. Next headline on the front page reads, Reynolds deploys state patrol officers to U.S.-Mexico border. We have an article from the 712 Initiative. It says 712 Initiative announces new director of programming and events. And then we have an article from the Capital Digest. Why don't we start with that first headline that says, Tyson attorneys seek to move COVID lawsuit to federal court. It was filed by Jeff Reintz of the Courier. Dateline, Waterloo. A lawsuit brought by relatives of two Tyson workers in Waterloo and Independence who died days apart of COVID-19 has been transferred to federal court. It's a move that hasn't worked for other coronavirus lawsuits against the meatpacking giant. Family members of Jeffrey Orvis and Arthur Scott, both of Waterloo, filed suit against Tyson Fresh Meats, Tyson Pet Products, and a list of plant officials and supervisors in Black Hawk County District Court in April 2021, alleging the company ignored warnings about the coronavirus pandemic and didn't take the necessary steps to protect its workers. On Monday, the suit was transferred to U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids at the request of the defense, claiming the allegations involved actions the company took at the direction of federal officers. Former President Donald Trump, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's, and the Department of Agriculture. Orvis, 65, who had worked at the Waterloo plant and died April 19, 2020. Scott, 51, was employed at the Independence facility and died April 23, 2020. Their deaths came as community leaders and health officials were calling for Tyson to close its Waterloo operation amid COVID-19 outbreaks. A call that the company dismissed for more than a week before shuttering the operation on April 22, 2020. In court records, Tyson denied the allegations, saying it invested millions in safety equipment and followed federal workplace guidelines. Tyson worked hand in hand with federal officials from the time of the declaration of national emergency on March 13th to safely continue operations to aid the federal government in accomplishing its duty to secure the national food supply, the company's attorney said in court records. Attorneys for the plaintiffs pointed out that Tyson had processed enough meat to increase its exports to China during the pandemic, and they noted the Independence plant, where Scott worked, doesn't make food, it makes dog treats. Although Tyson's plant manufactures dog treats, Tyson claims it is a critical infrastructure and essential to the nation's food supply. The suit states, the Independence plant remained open after governor issued an order closing non-essential businesses on March 26, 2020. Perhaps sensing the tenuous nature of its claim that manufacturing dog treats was an essential, employees were given a letter to carry with them, including that their work was essential, the suit states. Trial dates have not been set, and it isn't clear if the suit will remain in federal court. Similar suits against Tyson Foods, filed by the families of deceased workers, Skidka Buljic, Rabiriano Garcia, Jose Alaya, and Rizero Fernandez, had also been diverted to the federal court on similar grounds at the company's request. A U.S. District Court judge disagreed with the acting on the discretion of federal officers reasons for the transfer and sent them back to the Black Hawk County District Court in December. The decision to send these cases back is undergoing a challenge at the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which has put the case on pause. On to the next story. It is about the fireworks. The headline reads, Battery of Fireworks Stands Open Now in Council Bluffs. This was filed by Tim Johnson of the Nonpareil. If you want your Independence Day celebration to go over with a bang, you can stock up at more than a dozen firework vendors in Council Bluffs. And after all of the fun wiped out by the pandemic, business is good, said Michaela Patterson, coach of the dance team at Thomas Jefferson High School, which is operating the permanent Wild Willies store for the third independent season for a percentage of the sales. Since the shop is a permanent facility, it was able to open on June 1st. It is now open from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. through July 7th. Sales are already better than last year, she said Thursday. Patterson expects sales to skyrocket this weekend, although she added that the busiest days are July 3rd and 4th. We do probably half our sales on the 3rd and the 4th, she said. The team partnered with other organizations the last 2 years, but is going to do it alone this year, Patterson said. Staffing the fireworks shop has been a lot of work, but a great fundraiser for the dance team. This has been amazing, she said. This pays for competition fees. It pays for a lot of the girls' uniforms. We're hoping to take these girls to nationals this year. Patterson isn't sure which national competition the team would go to, but she's thinking about a National Dance Association event in Florida. The Wilson Middle School football team is running the fireworks stand in the big yellow and white tent at Bogmer's for the first time. Also for a percentage, said Yolanda Doss, a future football parent who is helping to staff the operation this year. Her son will be old enough to join the Wilson team in another year. Volunteers set up the tent on June 17th, and it opened on June 18th. It is open from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily through July 4th. We have new coaches this year, and they wanted to do this to help the boys' program out, Dawes said. We're using the tent to raise money for the kids' program and new equipment. We appreciate all the help and support we get. Patterson helped get them started, she said. Head coach Ryan Garrison is glad to have the option available for fundraising. He hopes the proceeds will pay for new blocking shields and other equipment. I'd love to get all new equipment for our kids, he said. There's pride in it. It gets them motivated. It gets them excited to come to practice. While Garrison doesn't know how much the team will raise from the effort, he feels it is going well. We're really excited, he said. We've done well already, and we've stayed steady. I think it's going to be a good thing for the team. Since they're doing business in a tent, they had to make some preparations to protect the merchandise Wednesday night, Doss said. We had to drop the sides of the tent, and we had to cover all the fireworks in here with plastic, she said. A security team guards the tent at night, she said. You must be 18 to purchase or discharge fireworks. They can be set off from noon until midnight, July 2nd to July 4th, on property owned by the user or with the permission of the owner. They cannot be discharged in areas zoned C3 or C4 downtown, and they cannot be shot off within 50 feet of a structure. On to the next headline story. This headline reads, Reynolds deploys state patrol officers to U.S.-Mexico border. This is by Rob Beauchart of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline, Des Moines. Up to 30 Iowa State Patrol officers will be redeployed for about 2 weeks to the U.S.-Mexico border to help law enforcement and border security efforts there, Governor Kim Reynolds and the State Department of Public Safety announced Thursday. Reynolds said she approved the action in response to requests from Republican Governors Greg Abbott of Texas and Doug Ducey of Arizona over the Emergency Management Assistance Compact between states. My first responsibility is to the health and safety of Iowans, and the humanitarian crisis at our nation's southern border is affecting all 50 states. Reynolds said in a statement, "The rise in drug, human trafficking, and violent crime has become unsustainable. Iowa has no choice but to act, and it's why I'm honoring Texas's Emergency Management Assistance Compact, following assurances from the Iowa Department of Public Safety that it will not compromise our ability to provide all necessary public safety services to Iowans." On June 10th, Abbott and Ducey formally requested law enforcement support from all 50 states through the Interstate Mutual Aid Agreement that enables states to share resources during a disaster, according to Reynolds' office. With the action, Iowa would join Florida, Nebraska, and Idaho, states all led by Republican governors, in sending law enforcement to assist Texas and Arizona. It is anticipated that approximately 25 to 30 sworn members of the department will travel to Texas in support of this request, said a statement from the Iowa Department of Public Safety. The deployment is expected to last approximately 2 weeks. Currently, the Iowa State Patrol has 360 sworn staff with 267 solely assigned to road duty, according to the department. Neither the department nor the governor's office responded to questions after the announcement Thursday of whether the border duties would require any special training or what powers Iowa troopers have outside the state. For officer safety purposes, the Iowa State Patrol does not provide specific operational details of missions, said Debbie McClung, a spokesperson for the Public Safety Department. A department email obtained by WHO-TV said that the state will be soliciting officers to travel to Texas to support this request. "We anticipate the travel dates will be July 8th through the 23rd, 2021. Under the Interstate Pact, the states requiring the aid must reimburse other states that provide it for the cost." In a news release, Reynolds' office said the Iowa National Guard currently is conducting a mission with 24 soldiers from the Unit 234 Infantry Brigade Combat Team to assist law enforcement agencies at the southern border, per an October 2020 request from the federal government. In May, there were roughly 180,000 border encounters and a 20-year high, according to the governor's office. Also, U.S. Customs and Border Protection in March reported a 233% increase in fentanyl seizures from the previous year. In May that year, over-year increases climbed to 300%. In Iowa, law enforcement officials are recovering drugs, illegal narcotics, and weapons being smuggled across the nation's southern border by drug cartels, the governor's office added. Manny Galvez, a North Liberty resident and Catholic Worker House activist, said Reynolds should be welcoming immigrants to Iowa, not sending state police to the border. "This is crazy. The governor denied welcoming children, and now she is sending the police. How harmful and an absolutely irrational waste of state resources," Galvez said in a statement. A spokesperson from the Iowa City Catholic Worker said the organization has helped admit 10 refugee families into the country since January 20th, after they were initially expelled back to Mexico under a federal order. The group has 18 cases pending with the American Civil Liberties Union, and its members also have helped our 4 families reunite with unaccompanied family members this year. Reynolds made her deployment announcement on the eve of Vice President Kamala Harris's planned trip to the U.S.-Mexico border at El Paso, Texas. The Harris visit follows weeks of criticism that she hasn't visited the area despite being tasked by Biden's administration with trying to alleviate the flow of migration over the southern border. Conservatives have been pushing Harris to visit the border for weeks as they raise alarms over a record number of unaccompanied children who have crossed into the United States this spring. Former President Donald Trump plans on touring Texas' southern border next week with Abbott, who recently announced that Texas will take steps to build its own border wall and has touted Operation Lone Star, an initiative to bolster state law enforcement presence at the border. Reynolds previously criticized Biden's administration officials' lack of transparency in flying 19 refugee children to Des Moines to be transported to sponsor families without notifying her or other Iowa officials. The action occurred, she said, despite her previous rejection of a federal request that immigrant children be housed in Iowa. Reynolds and other Republicans have asked the State Judiciary Committee to hold a public hearing about the movement of migrant children into states after unaccompanied refugee children were flown into Iowa without her office being notified. Next up from the front page, we have the 712 Initiative announces new Director of Programming and Events. The 712 Initiative has announced their new Director of Programming and Events, Julia Woods. Woods, a Council Bluffs native, was hired to develop, plan, implement, and oversee designated 712 Initiative community events, programs, organizational gatherings that make Council Bluffs a dynamic, healthy community. This includes Farmers Market Council Bluffs, Creek Top Gardens, Shamrock Shuffle, and Biketober in the Bluffs, just to name a few. Julia is going to be a fantastic part of our team with her vision, experience, and network, said Cheryl Garst, CEO of the 712 Initiative. She truly lives the mission of the organization and will keep up our success in activating the community's public spaces. Before this position, Woods spent the past 3.5 years as a project specialist at Woodman Life, responsible for the coordination and communication of the Patriotic program and related community events. She has a degree in business administration and management from Iowa Western Community College. The Director of Programming and Events works to increase social connectedness of residents in Council Bluffs and enhance community life and well-being. I'm excited to be working for a nonprofit within my own community, Woods said. I have been involved in community outreach for the past 3.5 years, and I was helping everybody except my hometown. I want Council Bluffs to be a place to grow and live for a long time to come. I have been here my entire life, and I would like to see my children come back after college and also be lifelong residents. On to the last front page article. The headline reads, Capital Digest. This was filed by the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A roundup of legislative capital news items of interest for Thursday. Flood mitigation funding. Cedar Rapids, which pushed for a state sales tax diversion program to finance long-term flood mitigation projects, has had projects totaling $269.4 million approved by the Flood Mitigation Board, which oversees the program created by the Iowa legislature in 2012. That's 45% of the $595.9 million approved by the board for projects in 10 Iowa cities, according to a report from the Legislative Services Agency. That includes $111.1 million for Des Moines and its Metropolitan Wastewater Reclamation Authority, $98.5 million for Dubuque, $9.8 million in Coralville, and $8.5 million in Iowa City. The program diverts sales tax revenue to fund local projects. Local governments are permitted to issue bonds that will be repaid with the sales tax revenue made available under the program. The bonds can be replaced with the sales tax revenue, which local governments are allowed to receive for flood mitigation for up to 20 years after the local government's project has been approved by the board. The diversion of sales tax revenue from the growth in retail sales in the participating cities has a dollar-for-dollar negative effect on the state general fund. From fiscal 2014 through May 24th, 2021, a total of $185.7 million has been transferred from the state to the sales tax increment fund, with $176.1 million sent to the approval local governments. Kids count. Iowa ranked 9th among the states and District of Columbia for children's well-being in the 2021 Kids Count report card from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Since 1990, the Casey Foundation has ranked states annually on overall child well-being using an index of four key indicators capturing what children need most to thrive: economic well-being, education, health, and family and community. In the most recent reports, Massachusetts ranks first, followed by New Hampshire and Minnesota, Vermont, Utah, New Jersey, Nebraska, Connecticut, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Iowa ranked 7th in economic well-being, 13th in education and health, 10th in family and community. Despite gains since the Great Recession, the 2019 data issued in compiling the report shows the nation is not ensuring every kid has the opportunity to thrive, according to Kids Count. Child poverty remained high, reading and math proficiency rates were still unacceptably low, long-standing racial disparities persisted across the board. The report did not reflect the impact of the coronavirus impact, the authors noted. DOT holiday closings. The Iowa Department of Transportation business locations will be closed July 5th in honor of Independence Day. Driver service centers, typically closed on Monday, will be operating by appointment only and closed July 3rd and 5th. However, many people may be able to complete driver's license business online at iowadot.gov/pound/services. The Iowa DOT recommends that commercial vehicle operators plan ahead if they will need services around the 4th of July holiday. Commercial vehicle operators who need oversize overweight permits for travel in Iowa on July 6th should attain them before 4:30 p.m. July 2nd. No movements of oversize overweight loads will be permitted in Iowa from noon July 2nd until 30 minutes before sunrise July 6th. Because the permit center typically experiences a heavy workload the day after the holiday, customers are urged to submit applications for oversized, overweight permits, especially those more than 156,000 pounds, several days before needing the permit. That wraps up the front page of the Nonpareil. Why don't we dig into some more stories? First off, we have Face of the Day. Maribel Weldon is the convenience banker manager at Midwest Bank NA, a position she has held for 9 years. Midwest Banks NA is a proud silver sponsor of the 2021 Wheels of Courage Car Show. As a community bank, we are glad to support wonderful local projects such as Wheels of Courage. We know it takes the entire community when it comes to supporting people going through a cancer diagnosis, and we are willing to help in any way that we can, Weldon said. The volunteers behind Wheels of Courage, such as Jeremy Knoll and Carol Elder, are tireless workers who make it their mission to help as many cancer patients and families as possible. Many of us have been touched by cancer in one way or another, and we're happy to help those who are helping others in that process. In her spare time, Maribel enjoys spending time with her husband Brett and their 3 children, Isabel, Brooklyn, and Jacoby, along with their dog, Yachty. For hundreds of Methodist Janine Edmondson Hospital patients in genuine need each year, coping with serious illnesses and mounting medical bills at the same time can be overwhelming. Funds raised during the Wheels of Courage show help relieve some of the financial burden by assisting patients with everyday living expenses such as groceries, rent, and transportation. The 6th annual Wheels of Courage takes place at Quaker Steak and Lube on June 26th. For more information on how you can participate, call 712-396-6040. Next story, moderate to severe drought conditions persist in Iowa. Recent rains are helping, though. This was filed by Rob Borchardt, the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline, Des Moines. Much of Iowa is facing moderate to severe drought conditions, but timely and beneficial rains have, at least, stabilized conditions for stressed crops, farmers, and gardeners. The latest U.S. drought monitor issue Thursday shows severe drought for a large part of this state, 44% versus about 40% last week, in an area covering much of northern and central Iowa. That number stood at 8% at the start of June. More than 90% of the state is abhorrently dry, and 3/4 of Iowa in the least moderate drought. A small but growing number of counties in southeast Iowa are reporting normal soil moisture conditions. Generally speaking, much of northern Iowa either stayed the same or got worse in terms of the drought depiction this week, said Curtis Rignati, a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center, who co-authored the latest U.S. drought monitor. Historically, Rignati said, "This is one of the most significant droughts I've seen in Iowa in the past century, but it has not been as dry as the 2012-13 period. Iowa will need above average moisture and below average temperatures to flip the negative trends that gradually have worsened since the spring planting and summer growing season unfolded." Not the driest June, Justin Gelsen, Iowa State climatologist, said the past few days of rain were not reflected in the drought report issued Thursday. But the rainfall helped move this June from the driest part in the state history to number 8 on the list, with a statewide average of 1.51 inches, tied with 1956, the 6 days remaining in the month. "We received rainfall right when crops needed it the most, especially after the hot and dry start to June, which is typically the wettest month for the northern two-thirds of the state," Gilson said. "The forecast into the week looks excellent for measurable rain through the weekend," he said, "but we need forecasts like that through July and August." However, he said, long-term precipitation benefits on the order of 10 to 20 inches go back 6 months to more than a year in the driest parts of Iowa in the northwest and west central sections of the state. "As we move forward, we would need to see at least an inch of moisture to hold conditions and in the drought monitor map status quo," Gilson said. "If we remain in a wet pattern, we could see improvement through July and August are the hottest months of the year, and thunderstorms have become more variable. Along with moisture crops using more subsoil moisture, conditions could deteriorate during a dry, hot stretch of days," the state climatologist added. "In general, we need constant and in some places over average participation over the next several months to put a dent in the long-term deficits." The water levels down. The weekly water summary update issued Thursday by the State Department of Natural Resources indicated Iowa precipitation totals in June remained 2 inches below normal, with nearly the entire state in some form of dryness or drought. As a result, stream flow is down across the state, and concern remains for shallow groundwater availability, and Tom Hall, DNR's coordinator of hydrology resources, said Tom Hall. But with rain in the offering, conditions should improve by the next water update on July 10th, he said. A weekly crop report released Monday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture indicated 64% of the state's topsoil moisture level has rated short to very short. It said 69% of soil moisture was in that same range, with crops showing signs of stress from the lack of participation and the high heat. You are listening to a reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, June 25th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We will now turn over to today's obituaries. There is only one obituary for today. Walter Wilson. Walter Wilson, age 83, passed away at his home on June 23, 2021. He was born April 4, 1938, to George and Flo C. Wilson in Pacific Junction, Iowa. Walter graduated from Missouri Valley High School with the class of 1957. He retired from the Union Pacific Railroad and was a farmer. Walter is survived by his wife of 63 years, Fernal Wilson, children Tim Wilson, Rod Wilson, Doug Wilson, Randy Wilson, Brad Wilson, Vince Wilson, siblings Bob Wilson, Tom Wilson, Keith Wilson, Karen Berner, 19 grandchildren, 28 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Hoy Kalinske Funeral Home on Sunday, June 27, 2021. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. at Hoy Kalinske Funeral Home on Monday, June 28, 2021. Interment is in Ridgewood Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. Here is today's Dear Abby's. Dear Abby, I've become involved with a woman I've been friends with for some years. We have become close over the course of 2020 and more recently have soft-launched dating, although she doesn't yet feel comfortable labeling it. Not long ago, she expressed great disappointment because of my messiness when I last visited her. I had left an empty coffee cup on her car floor, my shoes in the middle of her kitchen, and knocked some pillows off the couch, among other things. I know her criticisms are fair, but they were also over the top. I believe this is a trait I can fix, and I told her I would, but now she wants some more space. She said she isn't sure if she can become romantic with a messy person who doesn't respect her space. While I understand where she is coming from, I am afraid I won't have the chance to prove myself. We spoke a little after the incident, but I have tried to honor her request. Do you have any advice about how to approach the situation? It would be sad if we parted ways after our first real challenge. I think it may be important to note that in the past, she has dated men who weren't respectful to her at all. Mr. Messi in Pennsylvania. Dear Mr. Messi, a serious but non-confrontational conversation with this woman is in order. Does she have a touch of OCD, or could she be reluctant to become further involved for some other reason, such as a fear of intimacy or her bad luck with prior men in her life? You need to ask what has caused your otherwise happy relationship to go so far off track. Let her know you are willing to work on your messiness and ask her to lay her cards on the table about what else may be bothering her. Dear Abby, my wife and I have a beautiful 8-year-old daughter. She was an egg donor baby, and we had three miscarriages and were unable to bring a baby to term. My question is, when is the right time to tell our daughter that her mother is not her birth mother. I was bullied extensively as a kid and didn't want this to become a topic to taunt her the rest of her school days. Doting Dad. Dear Dad, I'm sorry you were bullied as a child, and I'm glad you asked this question. If your wife carried your daughter to term, she is the child's birth mother. She just needed a little extra help from a donated egg. Having reached the age of 8, your daughter is at an age when school curriculum may begin covering reproduction. After she has learned the basics, consider slowly starting to educate her about the various pathways to parenthood. Then, when she is a little older, provide more details about the miracle of her birth. It is important that your child know she can always get honest answers from both of her parents, and at some point, the donor's medical history may be something she needs to know about. Rolling on over to the sports section, the story reads, CWS friends keep the good times rolling. This is filed by Christopher Burbach of the Omaha World Herald. Randy Workman was backing his red pickup with personalized Husker plates into a prime tailgating spot outside Rosenblatt Stadium when a Louisiana truck rolled up carrying 4 guys. The Southern gents stopped on the street on that College World Series morning in 2002. Could they park there? They asked the Nebraska guy. Sure, just go around the corner and pay your $10 at the parking lot entrance, Workman replied. I just kind of flagged them in, he said. They parked beside us and the rest is history. Thus began a friendship that has lasted 20 years and counting. The Louisianans, mostly LSU fans, come to Nebraska for the CWS whether or not their teams make it to Omaha. They pull a trailer stuffed with vitas from Bayou Country. They cook their super regional specialties for anyone who cares to partake. The group is tailgating together again this year, just like always. There is the kind of history that happens here off the field that makes the relationship between Omaha and the College World Series so darn warm and fuzzy. It's more the friendship and the cooking and the enjoying this, Doug Gurdy of Lafayette, Louisiana, said while stirring a steaming pot of crawfish Monday morning. Going to the games, we're big college baseball fans, you know, and we keep in touch all through the year. English with occasion flavor has long been a lingua fresca of Bonvitas in Omaha for the College World Series. The Bayou boys and girls of summer have integrated generations of goodwill by serving up generous plates of jambalaya and crawfish au foie with ample portions of Southern hospitality and easy conversation on the side. That tradition goes back at least to the 1990s. This particular crew has its roots in 2002. Gurdy had made his first trip to Omaha with LSU in 2000. He returned 2 years later, despite the LSU team's absence, with a frantic 4 that included Steve Evans, Jeff Hyde, and Timmy Daigle. They hit it off right away with Workman and an Omaha buddy of his, Larry Burde. They had a good time in the parking lot and at the games. When that 2002 series was over and they said their farewells, the Louisianans said they'd be back. Workman wasn't sure they'd ever see each other again. But by golly, they came back and they came back and they came back, he said. Led by Evans, the people from the South began bringing enough food to feed the masses. Gurdy figures they fed upward of 150 people a day in those Rosenblatt days. The friendship crew grew, he said. It's almost like a family, said Earl Leager of Lafayette, Louisiana. There are thousands of stories about a myriad connections, like how retired Omaha firefighter P.J. Driscoll and his son, Pat Driscoll, got into the crew. Evans and company had given PJ a great plate of jambalaya outside Rosenblatt. He sent Pat over on his bike the next day to get the recipe, but They got to talking, and they're still tailgating and talking. The group even has a pastor, the Reverend Bill Moorhead, Workman's former pastor at Pacific Hills Lutheran Church, attends the opening day tailgate on Sunday and says a blessing for good food, good baseball, and good friendship. Over the years, the CSW Friends put together a golf tournament in Omaha. They've hunted and fished together. Workman and his wife, Joan, have visited Louisiana Friends several times, attending LSU football and baseball games in Baton Rouge. On Wednesday night, the Omaha couple was taking a break from the CWS to go out to Brother Sebastian's with Louisiana buddies Ray and Cecile Guthrie to celebrate Workman's birthday. But the CWS is the main event. Workman takes off 2 weeks from his drywalling business for it. It's the best 2 weeks of the year. They survived the CSW move to downtown Omaha, although their tailgate, now headquartered at Creighton Soccer Stadium, has gotten smaller and doesn't feed the masses so much anymore. They've seen kids in their crew grow up and bring their own kids now. The friendship has also survived two recessions, Louisiana hurricanes, a pandemic, and an American political polarization. They don't talk about the latter. How long will it last? Write this for end of your story, Gertie said, just before banging a pot lid to call people up for Monday's ouffé. And it never ends. Dot, dot, dot. Up next, some college football. Hawkeyes welcome return of summer routine. Steve Batterson, Quad City Times. Iowa City. Riley Moss isn't lifting weights in his friend's driveway anymore. This summer, Nico Reggini and Thorne Tracy don't find themselves looking for an open patch of grass at City Park or an open gate at high school field to play a little catch with Iowa quarterbacks. Standing inside a club area at Kinnick Stadium late Tuesday afternoon, Kyler Shute could almost feel the energy of the game day, although the stands won't be full until early September. There's a feeling that things are getting back to normal, the Iowa offensive lineman said. It's a great feeling knowing that there are going to be fans here walking into the baseball facility. It's all a big deal. University of Iowa players have been participating in summer strength and conditioning work for the past 2+ weeks and will begin some 7-on-7 work Wednesday. The familiar routine has become the routine again as the Hawkeyes move forward with a post-coronavirus pandemic approach as they work toward the start of the 2021 season. We're back to the way it was 2-3 years ago, Shute said. Everyone is in there right now. No one is sitting out because of COVID or whatever. It's not 100%, but it's getting close. We're back to training as a team. Coach Kirk Ferentz senses a return to normalcy as well. He said Iowa dealt with its latest COVID-19 issues shortly after the Iowa Hawkeyes returned for the start of the spring semester when two players were sidelined as offensive conditioning work started. Tracy said there is an entirely different mood surrounding Iowa's summer work compared to a year ago at this time when Hawkeyes were finding their own ways to condition and prepare for what ultimately became a delayed 6-2 season. It's very different inside the facility last year. The medical staff, the coaches, were on us to make sure we weren't in any contact with anyone with COVID so we could have a season, Tracy said. They're still kind of honest, but not really as much. Some of what is a byproduct of a number of players taking advantage of the opportunity to be vaccinated. When I could get vaccinated, I did, Reggini said. It's a very different situation now. Things are getting back to normal. Ferentz said Tuesday a number of Iowa players and staff members have been vaccinated, but he said he didn't believe university policy would allow him to require it. I think everybody has got to make their own choices, he said. I know there's a lot of factual information and a lot of not factual information out there too. Like his parents, Ferentz welcomed a return to more of a regular routine. The Hawkeyes are preparing under the mantra of prepare hard, rest hard. This summer, working to maximize both preparation time and breaks designed to keep bodies fresh and ready. Ferentz likes the progress he has seen from his team since it began working toward the 2021 season in January. We're pleased with the way guys finished up spring practice on May 1st. The guys have had a nice break and we're back, he said. The biggest thing right now is trying to make sure they understand how important this phase is. It's about our guys focusing on what they're doing in the conditioning, working on their own, and in 7-on-7. This is when a lot of progress can be made. Moss, focusing on growing his game in a veteran secondary, welcomes the change to make that progress. So far this summer, it just feels like another year, Moss said. Last year was so weird. Working out on your own last summer, walking into those empty stadiums, it was so different. But now everything seems normal again, which feels great. It feels good to be back in a routine. All right, jumping back into some news stories. Next headline reads, leader of Iowa's biggest public union to retire. Hoffman unsuccessfully fought lost stripping bargaining rights from public employees. This was filed by Rod Borscht of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Danny Hoffman, the leader of Iowa's largest public employee union, has been an outspoken critic of the state restricting collective bargaining rights and leaving his union's prison employees in jeopardy from understaffing, announced Wednesday his plans to end his 16-year run as president of American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employee Council 61 next month. In a statement, Homan, 68, and AFSCME employee for over 33 years and president since 2005, said he plans to retire at the end of his term and a new president will be elected at the union's upcoming convention July 24th. I am proud to have had the trust and support of the members of this council for the last 16 years, Homan said in his announcement. Working here has been the honor of my life. Every day I knew thousands of people were counting on me and this council to have their back, and I am proud to say that we did. AFSCME Council 61 represents more than 50,000 members in over 230 bargaining units across Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. In both the good times and the bad, AFSCME was there fighting for the hardworking men and women of the state of Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri in our cities, counties, schools, state, and private sector employees, Homan said. While there is a lot of fight left in me, I know that now is the time for new leadership to move the council forward. Homan was at the helm of the union during a sometimes tumultuous period that spanned the administrations of four governors, two Democrats and two Republicans. When he was the lead union negotiator in contract talks with the state policymakers and a major player in workplace issues, the union leader fought against changes the Republican legislature made in 2017 to diminish the state's collective bargaining law that had stood since the 1970s, and led an unsuccessful legal challenge that ended with an unfavorable Iowa Supreme Court ruling upholding the law signed by former Governor Terry Branstad. Homan countered efforts to weaken union membership by working to retain more than 90% of AFSCME locals during recertification elections required by the legislation. Homan became a member of AFSCME in 1986 when he worked as an officer with community-based corrections in Sioux City. He joined the staff of the AFSCME in 1988 as a staff representative and became Council 16 president in 2005, running unopposed for re-election as head of the union that battled for wage increases and benefits, protecting health insurance benefits in particular, during times of state budget surpluses, deficits, and economic recession. According to an AFSCME news release, Hoffman began his stint as president by working to unify the union after years of division. He fought for and served new policies that helped hundreds of thousands of people across the state, including raising the minimum wage, marriage equality, and expanding Iowa civil rights law. In about the last 2 years especially, Hoffman has been a frequent critic of what he has described as dangerous understaffing at Iowa's prisons that exposed corrections workers to inmate assaults. In March, two state employees at the Anamosa State Penitentiary were killed in what authorities said was a failed escape attempt. Weeks later, lawmakers agreed to more than $20 million, or about 5% increase, to the Department of Corrections budget. But the important work done was not because of one person. It was because our amazing members and staff who get up each day and keep the state of Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas running, Hoffman said in his announcements. While I may be stepping down from this position, I won't stop fighting for our members and for the policies that show them the respect they have earned, he added. And with the time we have left, why don't we do a little bit of a weather update? Forecast: chance of showers today, storms likely tonight. This is by Rachel George of the Nonpareil. Today will be partly sunny with a high of 86, according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. There is a chance of showers before 1 p.m., with chances of rain become more likely between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. A thunderstorm is possible. After 4 p.m., showers and thunderstorms are likely, mainly before 1 a.m. Chance of precipitation is 70%. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with a low of 67. The forecast according to the Weather Service. Saturday, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly sunny with a high near 79, north-northwest winds around 8 miles per hour, new rainfall amounts between a quarter and half inch possible. Saturday night, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 1 a.m., partly cloudy with a low around 61. Sunday, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m., mostly sunny with a high near 82. Sunday night, partly cloudy with a low around 62. Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 82. Monday night is looking like mostly clear with a low around 61. Tuesday is going to be sunny with a high near 86. Tuesday night, it should be mostly clear with a low around 64. And Wednesday, sunny with a high near 88. Well, listeners and friends, that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I've been your reader, Maddie Ryan. You can catch a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org under the podcast page anytime. And as always, thank you so, so much for listening.
Exploring Science and the Sea. The colorful dwarf hawkfish has a colorful life story. Found on coral reefs from Australia to Japan, it lives in harems, one large male with an entourage of several females. If the male gets greedy, though, things can change. One of the females can become a male and take half of the harem. And researchers recently found that if the new male is challenged by another male, he can change back to a female. The hawkfish isn't the only fish that can change sex. In fact, it's a fairly common trait, especially among fish that live on reefs. Perhaps the best-known example is the clownfish. It lives in small groups in the arms of anemones. The largest member of the group is female, the second largest is the breeding male, and the rest are non-breeding males. If the female dies, the breeding male grows larger and becomes female. The largest member of the pack then becomes the breeding male.